I will. Good morning, everyone. The Senate Education E-12 Education Budget Division will come to order. Welcome, everyone. Today, we're going to have a presentation from the Department of Education. It'll focus on the Federal School Improvement Grant Program. We'll look at Minnesota's 34 lowest achieving schools. What's being done to help those schools? This is a federal grant. I believe it's $34 million or so, and it's being targeted for assistance. And we're going to have the Commissioner of Education, Alice Segrin, provide an overview and some of her insights. And we also have listed initially Patricia King, the Director for School Improvement at the Department of Education. I do know each of you here has a strong interest in it in the audience. I don't know if we'll have a chance for additional testimony. It depends on how the presentation goes, but we're aware of the request for additional input, and that'll either be today or at a future meeting. That said, welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm not going to talk a lot today. I would like to have Director Pat King really go through the school improvement grant criteria and also the process by which we selected these schools, and then I will certainly be glad to talk to you about any other things around the school improvement grants and the process that we'll use going forward. So,
okay, thank you, Commissioner Segrin, and for the members and testifiers, we are on television, and for presenters, any acronyms, please explain them, and as if you were in someone's home, which you are.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I really appreciate being asked to come here today and talk to you about the school improvement grants. We really believe that this is an opportunity for Minnesota, and as you said, Mr. Chair, there is approximately $34 million available to Minnesota to work with this core group of 34 schools to turn them around. Before you, you have a PowerPoint, and I'll go through that at a kind of a high level, but I would encourage you to ask as many questions as you would like along the way. I also have a follow-up document called the School Improvement Grant Implementation Plan for Minnesota, and this document was used as we went around the state and met with each individual school district and their staff to talk about what the identification process and what the next steps are with the school improvement grant.
Excuse me, Ms. King, and are these documents you refer to online on the department's website for persons wanting to?
They're being posted, currently being posted. Yes, they will be available online for people that would like to look at them.
Thank you.
Thank you. I will start with the school improvement grant PowerPoint, and again, I would just encourage you to please ask questions along the way. I will be up front and tell you that this is a fairly prescriptive program. We really don't have a lot of wiggle room at the department. In this grant program, there's a combination of funding from the School Improvement Grant Office itself and stimulus funding, and I'll talk about that a little bit, but as you all know, the purpose of stimulus money is to quickly and dramatically make some differences, and with this particular program is to quickly and dramatically turn around some schools. Each state has an allocation for school improvement grant funds. We've received an allocation in Minnesota since about 2003. We started at about $1 million, and this past year we're up to $5 million and with an additional $29 million in stimulus money. So I'll talk a little bit about that. The school improvement, I'm going to now go through the PowerPoint that you have in front of you. The school improvement grants, I'll start talking about the, we'll start with the purpose of the program, which is on slide 4. The school improvement grant program is really authorized under Title I, Part A. There are several parts to Title I, as you probably are aware, but Title I, Part A is all about increasing academic achievement for students. School improvement grants is authorized under 1003G, which means these are specific grants for specific purposes for specific schools to really look at achievement levels of students and really encourage high-quality teachers, professional development, and all various formats and different ways that you can turn schools around. Again, $5 million in school improvement grant funds were awarded to the state of Minnesota this year. We will receive another allocation next year of approximately $4 to $5 million. That funding will then also be added to this pot to continue working with these 34 schools. Again, $29 million in SIGERA, which we refer to as School Improvement Grant ERA funds, or American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funds, for a total of $34 million, and we have 34 schools on the list. We have chosen...
Excuse me, Ms. King, I assume that list of the 34 schools is in the testimony?
Yes, it's in the packet.
Okay.
We'll get to that in just a second, Mr. Chair. Thank you. The persistently low-achieving schools are also noted as the turnaround schools. There are a number of different names that these schools have been given, but at the end of the day, they're 34 persistently low-achieving schools. And in your PowerPoint, the Minnesota Department of Ed was required to identify the schools across the state of Minnesota. What's interesting about this definition or this definition and this calculation to determine the 34 schools was also authorized under the state fiscal stabilization funds. It was the same definition that was used under Raise the Top, and it is now the same definition and or calculation that is used for the school improvement grant funds. Minnesota had to have formal approval for our definition for this project. We have had the definition approved by USDE for both the state fiscal stabilization funds and the school improvement grant funds. That was part one in the process. What I would like to draw your attention to now is looking at a chart that's probably on page seven, and I'm just going to talk a little bit about the calculation, how it was determined, and then we'll work our way into looking at the different schools that were identified and the rationale for identification. In Minnesota, as with every other state, the first thing that we're required to do is look at the number of schools that are receiving Title I funding. The Title I schools that are in improvement, a stage of needs improvement. It could be corrective action, it could be restructuring, or just needs improvement. There are 283 schools in Minnesota. The first calculation, and this is called Tier 1, because Tier 1 means that these schools are receiving title, eligible for, and receiving Title I and in a needs improvement status. The first cut was looking at the bottom 5% of schools in terms of proficiency and growth. Proficiency for this calculation is defined as looking at math and reading for tested grades in that particular school. The school configuration was determined based on their org unit or their organizational unit or how they identify themselves in the state system. They could either identify themselves as a K-6, a 712, as you know. The second cut was looking at additional high schools which fall below the 60% graduation rate for the past few years. All of those schools make up tier one schools. The second cut that we looked at was the secondary schools that are eligible for but not receiving Title I funds. Those schools were the schools that were taken by surprise, because typically these schools have not been identified for having an improvement status. The district has chosen for one reason or another not to put Title I funding into those particular schools. A lot of times it's because they don't have enough funding. So those schools were looked at the very same way. They're eligible for but not receiving Title I funds. The first cut was looking at proficiency of tested grades, and the second cut was looking at growth on the growth model. And the second part of that are the high schools that fall below 60% on the graduation rates. Now, to make this a little bit more real,
Mr. Chairman, yes. Thank you. Ms. King, before you go on page 6, before the chart, it talks about Tier 1, Tier 2, and Tier 3, but in your graph it doesn't show where Tier 3 comes in.
Yes.
I read that as a subset of the Title I schools, but where does that come into play?
Very good question, Senator Hand. The Tier 3 schools in Minnesota are the schools, as with every other state, are all of the rest of the schools that are receiving Title I and in some form of status of needs improvement. There are approximately 225 to 250 schools in that particular pool of funding of schools. The school improvement grant allows states to make the determination to serve Tier 1. You have to serve Tier 1. You're required to serve Tier 2, but Tier 3 is an option. And so those 230-plus schools, Minnesota has chosen not to serve them for the very reason that we have $34 million, and if we're really committed to turning around our schools, it takes quite a bit of money to turn around a school. And so we made the decision to stick with the Tier 1 and the Tier 2 schools.
Sir Hand.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. King, so I understand, so what we're saying is that the only difference between the Tier 1 and the Tier 3 are whether or not we choose to include them in the program. Is that essentially it?
Ms. King.
There's a little bit of a difference in that these schools were rank ordered, and so the Tier 1 schools are the lowest performing schools in the group, and then you would work your way up. Maybe a little bit easier way to think about it would be the Tier 1 schools and the Tier 2 schools fall in the bottom 5%. The Tier 3 schools are about the 6 to 10% range. And so they're progressing on a little bit more. So we made the decision to serve the lowest performing schools.
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, another way to look at this, remember the discussion with No Child Left Behind and the concern that we had that we were kind of including everybody, every district, every Title I school in identification for being, struggling in their school performance. And so there was a lot of discussion about what we really need to do is to really zero in on those lowest performing schools and try to put resources in there to turn them around. Secretary Duncan said, many times there's about 5,000 sites across the nation that really have the lowest performing students that we need to do something about it. So for every state, the school improvement grants, the race to the top philosophy, all the other kinds of opportunities and grants and monies, that you're going to be seeing come out are really going to be focused on that kind of strategy. And so this school improvement grant is really reflecting that philosophy of trying to dig in deep to those lowest performing schools and helping them with strategies to improve and move their kids to some proficiency. Will it happen overnight? No. But if we can start to see some movement within these 34 schools and we learn some lessons about that, we'll be able to then maybe replicate that with our other next tiers of schools.
Senator Olson and Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, yesterday as we were reviewing the information about the two winning states proposals and as compared with Minnesota, one of the struggles we've had is that we have not been able to budge that achievement gap, but the two winning states had. Do we know how they did it? Do we know what kinds of strategies they used that were effective in their being able to close the achievement gap? And is there so that we could get down to some of the things that work? I mean, we kind of talk in generalize of putting resources in and this kind of thing, but what is it that you do that will make a difference? Because we got credit for pouring money, resources, into schools that tended to have the biggest achievement gaps, and yet we haven't seen the movement. So that alone isn't going to do it. But do we know what does?
Senator Olson, for our viewers, you're referring to Delaware and Tennessee as examples of and Commissioner, if you could respond.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, in Tennessee's case, they actually admitted point blank that they had some of the lowest NAEP scores in the nation, 42nd and 49th, respectively, in their math and
Commissioner,
reading scores.
And, Commissioner, if you could tell everyone what those scores mean.
The NAEP scores called the National Assessment of Educational Progress. That's what we call our nation's test or report card after the kids take it's a sampling of school of students that are tested all over the nation. That NAEP report card then is reported, and there's some comparability there. Tennessee actually, frankly, said that they have some of the lowest NAEP scores, and their tests and their standards were very misaligned with NAEP. And so what their strategy was to completely redo their standards, align more with NAEP. And what they are doing is creating a virtual school district for those turnaround schools that they've identified. And then they are going to be putting in place strategies that hopefully will turn their schools around. So point blank, they really do not have strategies necessarily that have been successful, but they are going to be putting in place some interventions that they think will be helpful by bringing in some turnaround specialists, et cetera. In Delaware's case, they actually had very good NAEP scores and actually have had some very good progress on their National Assessment of Educational Progress scores. So we have not dug into, and they also have created what they're calling partnership zones. So they are going to be working with each of the individual school districts. They are, there are two interesting states. Tennessee is a right-to-work state. Delaware is a union state, much more like us. So I've been looking at Delaware's strategy. Their partnership zones, they are looking at the four turnaround strategies that are required. And they're pretty specific. They are close the school, turn it into a charter, fire the principal, and half of the staff, or just fire the principal and do a transformation model. Those are the four choices that you have under Race to the Top or the school improvement grants. But what Delaware is doing is saying to their management and their union, you choose which one you want to do, then you negotiate around how you are going to accomplish that. Come back to the commissioner and tell him or her what you are going to do, and then you'll go forward with it. If you are at impasse and cannot figure it out, then the commissioner gives you another 30 days in which to negotiate, maybe try another strategy. But after that, then the commissioner decides what you're going to do for a turnaround strategy. But have we looked into Delaware's success on the NAEP and how they have been better at maybe a less of an achievement gap? No, we have not done that. All of them, though, are going to be bringing in outside evaluators and other kinds of turnaround specialists to work with these schools. They are not going to be dependent upon some of their traditional methodology. They are all looking at ways of doing this in many more robust ways.
Senator Olson, follow up.
Yes, so Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, then did I hear incorrectly that they have my understanding was that they had already had success in closing the achievement gap. You're kind of laying out more that, you know, the strategies to try to get there. Perhaps they were better than we are, but they have not. They still had a long way to go as well. Is that what's being said?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, in Tennessee's case, yes. They have a long way to go, but their plan was so specific and appealed apparently to the reviewers that they were successful. In Delaware's case, they've had better success in moving their students' national education progress scores more so than other states, but they still have a large way to go, and they still have chronically underperforming schools just like every state does. And so it's the strategy of how they're going to get there. They're creating partnership zones. Tennessee is creating a virtual school district where all of these schools will be moved into this with a turnaround head and specialists and people coming in and working with them. Delaware will have a similar. And if you're interested, both Delaware and Tennessee's plans are on the governor's the government education website. You can go in there and read about what they're specifically doing.
Senator Olson, one more follow-up.
Yeah, thank you. I hope that we don't.
I know you have Finance Committee.
Yeah, I hope we don't lose sight of the fact that it's the, you know, we're talking about kind of these umbrella changes, but lose sight of the child and what kinds of strategies are used with the children. I mean, that was what was driven home to us in our work on literacy, is that, you know, if you keep doing everything just as they are, you can change a principle. I mean, that's important. But still, there are strategies that these children need in order to learn, and the focus needs, we should not lose sight of that. So,
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, that is specifically what our focus will be on, is to help analyze the school's needs and then really bring in the very best practices to help those students achieve. So, indeed, if we go into a school and we find that their reading strategies or their literacy scores are poor, and they've used several ideas or strategies and have not met with success, we will pull out all the stops to see what other things that we can do based on the best practice that we can find. And many times, even in the rural areas, you'll have you will just not have the resources or the ability to do some of that. So we think that this is going to give our state and those schools a wonderful opportunity with some additional resources and support and help to really help a lot of kids. And then as we learn, hopefully these will be lighthouse examples that can then spread throughout the rest of the state.
Thank you.
Senator Bonner, followed by Senator Saxbaugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now I have different questions based on Senator Olson's line of questioning, but before I ask that, I want to go back to that the chart on page 7, and if I was looking at the definition of the persistently lowest achieving schools document on page 6, it says under Tier 2, secondary schools eligible for Title I but not served. Why would they not be served?
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, district receives Title I funds, and they generally focus first on their elementary and middle school students. And then if they have enough money after that, then they serve their high school. That's generally been the tradition. There's just not enough money to stretch it up through high school. That's why we have a lot of high schools in Minnesota that, quote, their district receives Title I funds, but there's just not enough money at the end of the day to reach up into the high school level.
Thank you. And then just another question with regard to the transformation model, and perhaps you're going to be going into that in more detail, but you were addressing it. And some of the activities that I have been most interested in more relate to the comments that Senator Olson made with regard to what are we actually doing with the students. And particularly the ones where we talk about our response to intervention model, increasing rigor, improving the student transition, I know extending the time, changing the calendar. Are those sorts of things, that is a possible strategy, correct? But is it also embedded within you also must fire the principal and do those other things?
Yes,
Ms. King.
Mr. Chair. Yes, those strategies, and we will go over those in a little more detail in just a little bit. But there are four models, as the commissioner spoke to, the transformation, the turnaround model, the closure, and the restart model. And each one requires very prescriptive, unique responsibilities. Within each model, and what is so different about this program is that this is not meant to be just another program on top of what's already happening. When we've met with schools, the question we asked is, what's going to happen in 3 years when this money goes away? And our response is, your school will look very different in 3 years. It will not look the same as it looks right now. And while, yes, there are some very specific and very required pieces here, there are also lots of opportunities for schools to really think about transforming if they really believe that there's an achievement gap and they really need to get to the heart of that achievement gap. Here's the opportunity for the whole social-emotional piece. Here's an opportunity to look at RTI in a very embedded and concrete way. Here's an opportunity to extend that learning day for the teachers and for the schools. And there are pieces in here that we'll talk a little bit about regarding the principal and that freeing up that principal to be the instructional leader and hiring a SAM, a site administrative manager, whose sole responsibility is to run the day-to-day operations of a school, leaving that principal alone, so to speak, so that they can be the leader of that building. So there are lots of interesting nuances within this program that we'll talk a little bit about. But
and Mr. Chair and Ms. King, those kinds of activities, and as I read through this, I know we talk about our dislike of having, you know, top-down approaches and the rigidity and the importance of local control, but to me, these things just jump off the page as such exciting opportunities for not just our state, but for those kids in our schools.
Mr. Chair, we completely agree. This is quite an opportunity for 34 schools to look at a new beginning, so to speak. And it's an opportunity that we talk a lot about, closing the achievement gap, but here this really does offer the opportunity to close the achievement gap with the funding, sufficient funding to go to make this really happen. The funding is available for 3 years, and so it's really a unique opportunity in the sense that the federal government has given us an additional year. So this money is good until September 30th of 2013, and our plan is to pull out the stops and not make this burdensome for districts so that they can have access to this money on an as-needed basis and not dole it out in little pieces. But we're going to be looking for some bold applications that are going to be coming in. There are opportunities for new leaders to come into schools and really think about the opportunity to start almost over again with a population and with teachers. And I know that can cause a lot of consternation for some people, but for other people, it's an exciting opportunity. So we'll talk a little bit more about in-depth about the models as we go through.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Seaman.
Just to add to that, also there are schools that have been identified that already may have started on their path to transforming themselves. But for the fact that they may have run out of resources or didn't have enough resources to really scale up some of the transformational things that they were starting to do. This will also help those schools that maybe have already started on the path. So it's not to say even that sometimes we're going to completely fresh start, but we've also, we will bring in an outside independent evaluator that will look at the good practices that are already going on in these schools, the things maybe that they're struggling with or that they even didn't recognize maybe that they needed to improve, and put those things together and then help scale that up. So I do want to make the point, too, that some of these schools have been surprised at their identification, but it is not to say that they haven't been doing some good work, too. But the results have not been sufficient enough to really help kids succeed. And so we want to come alongside them and truly help them be successful.
Senator Saxhog, followed by Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Director King and Commissioner Seagren. A question on back to our Tier 3 schools, and Commissioner Seagren, you mentioned that we're most closely we're more similar with the state of Delaware, of the two highest performing. How did Delaware deal with their Tier 3 schools?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Senator Saxhog, as I described their process with their Tier 1 and Tier 2, they did an identification process. Well, I don't know what they did with their SIG grants or the school improvement grants, and I don't even know if they've been awarded their school improvement grants yet, so I really maybe shouldn't speak. I know what they did with Race to the Top, but their turnaround strategies in Race to the Top mirror the school improvement. So all I can say is that the way they were going to approach they were still using the four strategies. They have to use those. But they were just saying to those, once you were identified, then you then chose which model you wanted to do. So X school site was chosen within a school district. Here's your choices. So you work with your school board and your superintendent and your teachers to decide if you're going to close the school, if you're going to turn it into a charter school, if you're going to use the turnaround model, which is fire the principal and half of the teachers, or if you were going to just fire the principal and use the transformational model, which has the other things. But you had to choose those four, one of those four, and then you negotiated around how that was going to happen with management and union. Then you came back to the commissioner and said, this is our choice, this is what we're going to do. And then what I'm assuming is that Delaware would do as the prescriptive languages that you bring in, people that come in and select best practice models or strategies. There are many, many organizations that are what they call turnaround specialists that have had really strong results. So you might have a list of America's Choice would be something that is very well known around the country as a very, very positive and powerful model of not only turnaround, but just a very strong model for any school district to use. Mass Insight is another one that's very well known. So there's lots of different frameworks that you can use.
Follow up, Senator Saxhog.
Yes. Well, thank you, Commissioner. But the question, that I have is that we've chosen not to invest in our Tier 3 schools. We've gone to one and two. So my question was, do we know if Delaware or any other state is chosen to invest in their Tier 3 schools?
Mr. Chair, I would suspect that Delaware, as is Tennessee, that they probably have limited resources that have to be expended, and they've probably stuck with Tier 1, Tier 2. But I have not, and I'm not even sure if Delaware has received a school improvement grant to comment on that and to see how far down they were going to impact all of their schools. That, you know, we have 283 that could potentially be served with $34 million over a three-year period of time. Do we want to choose to do it that way and serve all of them, or do we want to, you know, focus on the title or the Tier 1 and the Tier 2? Pat may have a comment on that.
Yes, Mr. Chair. What I'd like to clarify here is that our schools that are receiving Title I funding, in other words, our Tier 3 schools, are currently being served under our AYP, our Adequate Yearly Progress Statewide System of Support, which is another part of Title I. And so they're already receiving services through this regional model of support. This funding for this particular group of schools is in addition to that support or on top of what everyone else is already getting. So we are serving those schools.
Senator Torres-Ray, followed by Senator Saltzman and Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, we had a meeting with some of the, I wish we had the map in here where these schools are located. Some members, I have been talking to the members that represent those areas where the schools are located. And we have a very interesting mix and a conversation out of that analysis of location. For instance, one of the schools is in Senator Tom Bach's district, and he pointed to me that a lot of what we're seeing really relates to American Indian kids. It's a school that is located right there in the heart of the reservation. When talking to Senator Lurie, who has some of the schools, Senator Olsen, some of the rural senators, and Senator Scheid, what we concluded is that there is a high incidence of poverty in the areas where we will be working. And so it occurred to us that we really have to have a more proactive effort here in the Senate to figure out how do we work with you on that. And we haven't had that opportunity to talk. And so I have been trying to work with the Humphrey Institute and the university to see if we can do just some preliminary analysis about kind of the social conditions around these schools, because I think that is very important. And I wonder if you have done some of that analysis, if you're concerned, if you're connecting with some of the county agencies and some of the people that actually are very involved in the lives of these children. That one, and two, out of these conversations with the different members that represent these areas, we were talking about Senator Rummel's district, where in her district, they have been implementing this model where there is intervention that is strong academic intervention and strong social support. And we believe that we need to connect these two and have these analyses done at the same time. So I'm wondering if you have done any of that review or intend to do, because I'm going to venture to say that you're not going to be successful if you don't do that. And it's going to require some changes from a legislative perspective to really have, which is what Senator Rummel is requesting to review, with respect to what are the services that are provided to the county, how do we deal with poverty, how do we deal with parent counseling and really supporting parents in their effort to support kids, not just dealing with, you know, it is the teacher's responsibility, and if you don't do it, you just get fired, and then we hire somebody else.
Mr. Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, those are very good points, and this is exactly what this school improvement grant is intended to get at. It's intended to get at the entire situation in the school. I think one of the things that would be helpful to keep in mind is that our school improvement grant, Minnesota's grant, was submitted on February 8th and was approved on March 12th. We are on a very fast and compressed timeline to make sure that we have everything we need in place, because schools are expected to implement this on the first day of school, fall of 2010. And so we have very little time. But with that being said, we are pulling out all the stops at the department to make sure that we have everything in place that needs to happen. The next step, what the piece that's happening right now, is each of these schools are undergoing a quality school review, where a team is coming in to do a two-day review or diagnostic of what's happening in the school. And it's meant to look at challenges and successes, and really in an attempt to help those schools understand and have the capacity to be able to write a grant that is comprehensive, does address the model that is chosen, and ensuring that all of these different components can be implemented successfully in the school. Now, we all know that this isn't going to happen on the first day of school, fall of 2010, but we do know that we need to put pieces in place to ensure that we've got our lifelines out there, and we know we have to make sure that we have the people in place and the programs in place for these schools to be able to work with. It's also the department's intent to put together an Office of Turnaround Schools to oversee this very project. There's some admin money or administrative money here that can be used. We've chosen to hire or to put together an Office of Turnaround Schools, which is similar to what we had talked about in the Race to Top application, because we need to have an oversight group whose sole responsibility is to work with these schools to ensure that this work is done and they have the connections to the other agencies or counties or whatever it is that they need to have services for and with, in whether it's in Minneapolis-St. Paul or out in rural Minnesota. We also recognize that the concerns around the state with a lot of these schools are around poverty. And so we need to be able to help better prepare our teachers for the students that they have that are coming into their schools, because we aren't getting different students. These are the students, and this is how it is in Minnesota. And so we need to make sure that everyone has what they need to be prepared to teach these students.
Excuse me, Ms. King, is the Office for Turnaround Schools paid for out of the grant money?
Yes, Mr. Chair, the Office of Turnaround Schools will be paid for the administrative portion out of the grant money. The $34 million that flows into Minnesota, 95% of that is to be used directly for grants to schools.
90%?
95%. Okay. 5% is to be used for oversight and assistance. We are expected to do evaluation, provide technical assistance and a support to these schools so that they have the means that they need to put this program together. Each of the schools that are awarded funding will be required to hire or have on staff an individual who reports directly to the Office of Turnaround Schools, and the Office of Turnaround Schools staff will be directly assigned to each one of these schools. So this will be their job for the next 3 years to ensure that this work happens. Okay.
Senator Horace Ray, one follow-up, and we have two on deck, and then I'm going to see if we could give you maybe 15 uninterrupted minutes to complete the presentation. But the questions are excellent, and some of these points may be in future slides, and we'll proceed in that manner. Senator Horace Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to ask Ms. King and the Commissioner, I believe that it is very important that you incorporate a model of advisors into your process that actually includes the people that represent these areas, because we care very deeply about the outcome of this. And also, although the questions about other states are relevant and good, and comparing ourselves to other people, if you talk to the people who are doing the research, NCSL and all of the other people, what we find in education is that because education is locally driven and issues around poverty and community engagement is so local, that comparing states usually is not as advantageous and as useful as we think it is. And Minnesota is very unique in a sense that we have high concentration of poverty in certain areas and a lot of change in suburban Minnesota and growth. And states are different. And so I think that it is to our advantage to consult and work with local communities to do this rather than trying to figure out. Tennessee is very different from us. Delaware is just completely different from us. And so there is a lot of value, I believe, in trying to connect with the local communities, with the people who are working with the kids, with the counties, with the teachers. And I think we're going to find that we're going to go a lot faster if we do that. I have found the comparisons with states to be very challenging. And experts usually say, you know, Minnesota's kind of a unique case in terms of disparities. You guys, you're the first in the nation for all the kids, and then you separate children of color, and no one is like you. So how do we deal with that is a very important issue, and I hope that we're able to. This is a great opportunity for us to really turn around our state, but I think we're very unique in that regard.
Okay, Commissioner and Ms. King, I think you've earlier indicated support on the importance of those points made by Senator Torres-Rae, but if you'd like to reiterate that for the record.
Mr. Chair and Senator Torres-Rae, part of the strategy that we need to absolutely look at is what you're talking about. When Red Lake unfortunately had the terrible tragic shooting a number of years ago, our department immediately, of course, started working with them and asking them how we could partner with them. We didn't come in and say, we're going to do this to you, or you should do this, or you should do that, but we actually said, how can we work with you? And one of the things that I was very fearful was, would we have enough even health support, mental health support, for the families and for the students to deal with the tragedy and just the grief? But what we found out is as we started identifying all of the county and community support, it was amazing that there was a lot going on already in the community, but it was fractured and it was in silos. So when we started bringing everybody together around the table, so the department, public safety, community health, the county services, we found that we all had a lot of services available, but they were not coordinated. So we really didn't spend one more dime, but what we did do was start to coordinate and work with and funnel those services directly to those children and service and kids and families on the Red Lake Indian Reservation. So we actually brought together a lot of people. I think when we start to look at each of these individual communities, that's exactly what will begin to happen, too. I hope it will happen. We will certainly, I will direct Director King to make sure that that happens, because those are things that are also support services for families. We also need to look at strategies of connecting parents to the school. And we have a lot of nice examples in Minnesota that are already happening. Being able to scale those up, getting parents involved, engaged with their children's education, I think is fundamental. That's where education starts, is in the home. But a lot of parents don't know what to do. I can remember as I was a parent, too, about what do I need to do as a parent to help my child. So those are the things that we will be looking at, because it does need to be a holistic approach, particularly if you have areas of poverty.
Thank you. Senator Saltzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and also Commissioner. Just a couple of questions I'll ask both, so you can maybe sort of roll them into one response. And Ms. King, is I know we heard yesterday in the presentation on Race to the Top that one of the areas where we lost points was the fact that we could not close a district school versus we are able to close a charter school. So if you could just comment on that, on where that fits in this or what would be needed or how other states are addressing that. And then the second question is that I think to Senator Torres-Rae talking about, you know, we are Minnesota and very unique in some of the things that we do. Has there been some thought about how we might have a school that is similar in demographics to one of these targeted schools to maybe be a mentor school? Because when you look at the fact that, you know, I know that there's that when this list came out, it felt like a very punitive list, like, oh, our school is targeted. And I think that as Senator Bonoff said, that this is an opportunity to look at, to say there's an investment in this community to say these children cannot fail. And what are we going to do to help this community come together around its school and make sure that, you know, these children are very successful? So is there any thought about doing something like that so that it's not just this team that comes in, but sort of a team of peers? Because I think that too often we do look at this as, well, the teachers have failed, as opposed to this entire system, or it's a fresh start. So maybe just some thoughts on closing schools and then an idea about mentoring.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Senator Salzman, one of the things that the winning states were noted for is the fact that the commissioner or their superintendent, the agency, if you will, could actually have the authority to intervene in low-performing school sites. Now, under No Child Left Behind, as commissioner, I have the authority to go into a school district once they're identified for a number of years as being persistently underachieving. And I can go in and I can work with them, and I have the authority to intervene and say, you must, you know, start to do certain things. The states that won and many of the states that were on the finalist list actually cited the fact that their commissioner or superintendent had the ability to go in and directly intervene with schools that were not performing well. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, my colleagues around the country have gone in and come in and said, you're out of here, and shut the door and locked it. But they do have the authority to go in and say, we have to do something now, and you have to use your resources. You have to start looking at specific things to get things turned around. So I don't have that. What we're considering doing is asking for that authority as one of the things. We're trying to assemble a list of things that would demonstrate with our next application that we're much more serious about this. Right now, we're silent in the state, and so we kind of said, you know, we didn't push that issue, but it was very obvious that they were looking for certain kind of touchstone things that were important to them to show that the state was serious about this. And I believe we are serious about it, but, you know, we're also trying to look at, you know, other different strategies. But let Pat talk about mentoring propositions and things.
Ms. King.
Mr. Chair, Senator Salzman, the idea of mentoring is very intriguing to me. And I would imagine it's going to be very intriguing to the rest of these schools and the rest of our staff that as we put this thing rolls out and we put it together. And the reason I say that is because my division is also responsible for working with all of the schools in the state that have been identified in one way or another for not making adequate yearly progress. We look at this as a new opportunity to think about how can we pair what we've already, our lessons learned basically, with a new direction and a new opportunity that we can go, and to think about looking at some of these schools in different parts of the states and how they could truly be mentors to other schools. The whole feeling of these 34 schools being identified has been it's been very difficult. We recognize that for the principals, for the superintendents, for the teachers, everyone involved. And so it's having another school, and what we've learned from our lessons in Minneapolis and St. Paul with some of the schools that have turned around and been successful is that sometimes moving forward and 3 years later, you've learned so much and you have so many opportunities and so many good things have happened in your school that, yes, it was really a difficult thing to go through, but your school and your students are all better because of it now. And so looking at an opportunity for mentoring would truly be an opportunity because we've identified some of those schools who have done well across the state, and we can pair them up with individuals within their region. And I just would like to make one more comment to Senator Torres Ray regarding the advisory board, and that actually was included in our approved application. So we will be having an advisory board that will be put together to work with the Office of Turnaround Schools. So I just want to make that clarification.
Senator Rummel, and then we'll have Ms. King proceed with, I believe we're at page 8 on your slides. Senator Rummel.
Mr. Chair, my colleagues have asked the questions, and the commissioner and the director have answered the questions I had, so I'm good to go.
Okay. Thank you, and I want to thank the committee for their very probing questions thus far, and but if we could wait for about 15, 20 minutes or so to delve through at least the formal part of the presentation.
Okay.
Please continue.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to go rather quickly through this PowerPoint, and so there are some of the pages just for the sense of expediting this a little bit. I've got another handout that I believe explains some of this stuff in a little bit better detail, which is why I wanted to bring both of them. So we'll go through this, finish up this PowerPoint, and then turn our attention to the other piece, which is really the meat of what it is that we want to talk about, such as the models and different things today. And so we've talked a little bit about the identification of these schools. We know there's 34 schools. We know we looked at proficiency on the MCAs, Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments. We've also looked at, first of all, what we did when we identified these schools, we looked at proficiency on MCAs for math and reading combined, which is very different. So you look at proficiency over 3 years. But then in order to give the schools extra credit, we also looked at how they were doing, being on track for being proficient on the Minnesota Growth Model, and that is all in the second handout that I'll get to in just a minute. The next page that we have are the intervention models, and there's a lot of detail on these pages, and I've got another document that's a little more succinct, so just bear with me as we move a little quickly.
And members, I believe it's not numbered, but it's 2 pages after 7 on the turnaround intervention models.
Turnaround intervention model, we'll talk about that. Okay. The next page is the restart model, the closure model, and then we also have number D, which is the transformation model, and we'll go through all of those. As you can see, some of those are very lengthy, and they're very worthy of a discussion regarding some of the pieces on this. And so if you want to skip ahead to the section that is called SEA application, we have the eligible schools, alignment to raise the top and state fiscal stabilization. I apologize for not having page numbers on these. I think the next piece we want to talk about, if we move ahead a little bit, the evaluation of the LEA application. The LEA stands for Local Education Agency, which is also known as a district, which is also known as a charter school in Minnesota. So the evaluation, it is the department's responsibility to put out an RFP or request for proposal for these identified schools to apply. The district is responsible for their schools, just like the authorizer is responsible for the charter school. So it's the district who will apply for these funds on behalf of their schools. And so when we start looking at capacity and we start looking at the identified school, it's more than just the school. It's the district who now has to take ownership for what's happening within that school. And so this application will not be competitive among those 34 schools. Rather, each of these schools will determine an allocation amount of funding that each of these schools is each individually eligible for, and they can request up to that amount. And we're looking at a pretty sizable amount, if you can do the math a little bit. So these schools, as a school, would choose to drop off, or if a school closes, and we don't know that because some things may change, but if this list starts to whittle down, that funding then will be put back into the pot and redistributed to the eligible schools. So we aren't looking at opening this up to a larger grant competition. Rather, it's focused on these schools. They'll know what they're eligible for. That amount can only increase. It won't decrease. And so I think that will help with relieve, some ambiguity here. So the LEA's responsibilities, or the local education agency, or the district's responsibility, is that they need to analyze the needs of their school and select an intervention model. I know there's been some discussion about out there that the department has already predetermined an intervention model. I want to make it really clear that the department has not and will not determine an intervention model for these schools, because we're not allowed to do that. That is really the LEA's responsibility. The LEA or the local education agency needs to identify those the needs, and then I determine the capacity that the school has to actually implement this grant. Currently, in order to expedite that and help with that, as I said before, we've contracted with Cambridge Education to come in and do a quality diagnostic school review for each of these individual schools. Now, we also recognize that in some of these small rural schools, it's very difficult to disentangle the senior high school, for example, from the elementary school. And so what we've asked Cambridge to do and what we've contracted with them to do is come in and do a diagnostic of the entire district, so that we've got a true picture here of what needs to happen, because we know that we can't just separate some of these out. So it's going to look a little bit different in each of these different schools. We chose to go...
Excuse me, Ms. King, sure. What if a persistently low-achieving school in a district or a charter does not apply, or you don't reach an agreement?
Very good question, Mr. Chair. This is not a requirement that these schools apply for these funds. This is an option.
What do you project?
Well, Mr. Chair, we have received a letter of intent from each of the identified schools, or at least from the district of the identified schools. So in Minneapolis's case, it would be 7, all of the rest of them. We have, I believe, 3.
Excuse me, members, I believe on page 18 of the other handout, you'll see target schools.
Yes. Okay. And I'll, yes,
and
Mr.
we'll
Chair.
Get to that, yes. But I think we're all wondering how this will play out now. And but your projection for number of schools where you'll be able to reach an agreement, because I presume there are certain deliverables that are expected in the federal grant?
Yes, Mr. Chair, the deliverables for the federal grant is they expect to see these schools start making progress.
Quickly and dramatically.
Yes. So we've got until, and there are a number of reporting metrics that are just now coming out of U.S. Department of Education regarding what we will need to report back to the U.S. Department of Education on the progress that these schools are making. We don't have all of that detail at this time, but it, again, it is just starting to come out. The schools will be required to set proficiency goals, looking at math or reading. It could be math and reading, dependent upon their reason for identification. And they will need to show progress towards making those goals. The department will need to analyze that, or the Office of Turnaround Schools will need to analyze that annually. The same is the case for graduation rates. The U.S. Department of Education and the department is not expecting that you can go to 100% proficiency or 100% graduation. Rather, we're looking at increasing the rates of graduation. And that is, it's very, the states have an opportunity to define what that increase will look like. So we will work with the schools that are identified as they set their goals and ensure that they're setting rigorous goals for graduation or proficiency. So if you look at the PowerPoint again, we need to, as a department, as an Office of Turnaround Schools, we will need to evaluate a number of the district requirements that are in the grant, such as did they design and implement interventions that are consistent with the model that's selected. Another thing that we'll be looking at when we review these grants is whether or not they've aligned all of their resources. A number of these schools have professional development set aside. They get other forms of federal funding. They might be a QCOMP school. They might have other grants. We need to look to make sure that all of the work within that school is aligned so that there is a true focus on this grant and turning around this school, and also to ensure that funding is sustainable after this grant goes away. Also in the PowerPoint, we're looking at capacity. If we keep moving forward, the LEA has the capacity to ensure that their schools are able to implement this application or this grant with fidelity. So we'll be looking at that. And it's the department's then responsibility to ensure that the district is overseeing their schools. So there's a lot of responsibility here and a lot of oversight from the department to the district down to the school. If we continue to move on, I would just want to draw your attention to the application process and timeline. As you can see, and as I've stated, this is a very condensed and a very scaled-up timeline. Determining the low-performing schools was done on January 19th. Each of these schools was contacted individually by myself or a member of staff, the commissioner, or Deputy Commissioner Chaz Anderson. Throughout the month of the last two weeks in March, my staff and I went out and personally met with each of these identified schools, had a conversation about what the next steps were. The next thing that's starting right, I believe it started yesterday, were the conducting of the quality school reviews so that that information can be complete and sent back to the department for release to the schools in early May. The school improvement grant application will be posted to the grants management section on the department's website in early May so that schools can start thinking about and determining whether or not, number one, they want to complete the application, and also giving them an ample time to be able to write an application. Our division will also be conducting a number of technical assistance opportunities to help these schools write these applications, and we're now in the process of determining what kinds of support schools will need as they put this application together. This application is very comprehensive, as you can about imagine, and we want to make sure that we are not a hindrance to schools as they have to develop the application. Their applications are...
Senator Bonhoff.
Excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director King, based on this timeline, it looks like that you may need to use the LAC as an authority to appropriate the money. Is that your intention? How are you going to, when we're not in session, handle the finances?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonhoff, we've already received LAC approval.
Okay.
We were notified that we would be eligible for this funding, and I believe we submitted it at the end of the last session. So, thank you. Our intent here is to have these applications approved on or around July 1 so that districts can start receiving revenue already in case they decide to plan some activities for the month of August prior to the start of the school year. The next few slides really just talk about the state's responsibility. I talked a little bit about this already. I think the key here is that we need to make sure we annually review the district's student achievement goals to determine whether or not we can renew this. We need to ensure that the schools are making a good faith effort in moving forward and truly and working towards increasing student achievement or their graduation rates in order for us to continue approval. We fully expect that each school that commits to applying for and receiving these funds is committed to moving forward and complying with all of the necessary requirements.
Sarah Hinn.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. King, I don't want to interrupt you. I think you're near the end of your PowerPoint. Maybe we're going to talk about the other document. But I just want to clarify this process a little bit to make sure that we understand. The intervention, the schools that are on the list, as you've described it, are not required to submit an application to participate, although you said that they all have, or all the districts have, written some kind of inquiry to the department to indicate some interest. If it's not required and a local school or a school district decides they're satisfied with what is going on, or they don't trust the assessment, or for whatever reason they decide we're not going to go down this path, what happens? Is there any step that occurs if a school is on this list and they decide they do not want to participate or do not want to adopt one of the four models? What is the thing that happens there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, that's a very good question, and that's something that we're, in fact, I have a call into the U.S. Department of Education. As I stated earlier, this definition and this calculation had to be approved by the U.S. Department of Education for both state fiscal stabilization funds and for the school improvement grant funds. And while schools are not required to apply for this grant under the school improvement grants, we are not clear yet on what implications that might have for other funding. In the state fiscal stabilization application that Minnesota Department of Education on behalf of school districts, there was an assurance regarding turnaround schools or struggling schools, and that we would work with those schools. In the district application, there was also an assurance that the schools would work with their low-performing schools. We're looking for clarification on what exactly that will mean. It could mean, and I really say that it could mean, because this is a part of a Title I piece of legislation that districts may have to think about repurposing some Title I funds to work with that low-performing school. It could mean that maybe districts will have to think about state fiscal stabilization funds and repurposing some of those funds to work with the low-performing school. If a district chooses not to, or a school chooses not to apply for these funds, they are not relieved or moved off the list. This list remains as is. And so we're, again, seeking clarification, and we can get that information as soon as we receive it. We'll send it over.
Yes, to us?
Yes.
Thank you. Senator Hand, fellow.
Yes. And just to kind of go down that path a little bit, so one of these 34 schools, they apply, they adopt one of these turnaround intervention models. And you indicated that there was some expectation then that improvement would be seen. Is there a specific timeline in mind? And whatever that might be, what happens if there is not progress that is shown? Then what happens if they've gone through this process, they've adopted a model, they spend whatever time they're allotted by whatever the expected criteria is, and they don't show improvement by whatever that definition turns out to be, then what happens?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, very good question. We don't know what that means in the future because we haven't seen anything that really talks about it. There's some hope here that this will improve schools. It's, as an agency, it's our responsibility to ensure that these schools are working towards making progress. And so as an agency, again, one of our responsibilities is to ensure that these schools are making progress towards meeting their goals, which is why we are required to analyze progress each year and indicate that progress is being made each year. And I believe that the Office of Turnaround Schools will intervene with that school to ensure that to maybe do another quality diagnostic to determine why progress isn't being made and really look at the intervention model that was chosen to determine whether or not that intervention model is the one that truly should be implemented, or are there some adjustments they need to make within the grant that they applied for themselves. So it's really taking a holistic approach to looking at, if you're not making improvements, it's not just about students and test scores. Let's look at the entire situation. And
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hammond.
Just one of the slides here, I think about the fifth one from the back, it talks about if the state education agency intends to take over a tier one or tier two school. So I guess part of my questions earlier were getting at, it seems as if there's an anticipation that at some point the State Department is going to take over the school. And I'm just, when does that happen? How does that happen? What is that process like?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, I will address the very first part of that, and I'll let the commissioner take the rest of it. And the assurances that you see in this document are assurances that are used across the United States. In some cases in Minnesota, we recognize that this will most likely not apply, at least for a number of our schools. But I'll let the commissioner finish that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hand, yes, that's true. I don't have the authority to go into a school site, so this is a strategy that would be applicable for a state whose commissioner has that authority to do that. So I would not have that. In regard to your question, though, about what happens if you're kind of in the middle of this process and you're starting to see that it doesn't happen, or what if it at the end of the 3 years if it doesn't? Internally, once the strategy is selected, let's say the district decided to close a school. Well, that means, and then they also have to then place those students in other higher performing sites. So we would be watching and following those students to see if indeed their academic achievement improved. If you take the second turnaround strategy, we decided to turn the school site into a charter school. We would be watching the charter school's progress to see if they're really impacting the student. We would certainly, if a year into the process, if it looked like that charter school was struggling, wasn't doing well, we would definitely be intervening to see what we could do if their educational strategies were not working. The same thing with the other two, where you remove the principal and half of the staff, you rehired new staff and a new principal, and of course, in addition to that, that's just not all that is expected. We would expect that there would be a lot of, as Senator Olson alluded to at the beginning of our conversation, what are your good reading strategies if your reading scores are poor, or math, or et cetera, whatever your issues are. Plus, what are the community sports if you have a high poverty, as Senator Torres Ray? It's a holistic approach. So we would have some time once that turnaround strategy or intervention is selected within that 3 years to, continue. That's why we have to continually monitor to see if there are any red flags that are going up. Same thing for the fourth. I think what the federal government, Secretary Duncan and President Obama are trying to do with these four strategies is to say, are there strategies that we can look to that we learn from that can really successfully intervene and help our students that are struggling the most succeed? And so I think this is going to be this grand experiment, if you will, very bold, very uncomfortable experiment at this point that a lot of us are feeling. But the challenge has been put down. We can no longer let these children fail. And so they're saying we're going to do some bold things. Sometimes we're not all in agreement as to what those strategies should be. But we've received some money. We're going to try to do it, and we're going to try to do it to the best of our ability in the fairest way possible for those schools and the best way possible.
Commissioner, on the funds that would be available to schools, will they need to come up with some thoughts on how they might sustain that after the grant? And as well, have you thought about part of the payment being based on actual results? So that if you don't have results consistent with QCOMP, Race to the Top, et cetera, that you're not going to get as much of a reward.
Mr. Chair, very good question. Actually, one of the models, the transformation model, actually allows for payment and reward for teachers and administrators making gains in their schools. But overall, unless that's built into the model, the department doesn't have the authority to say we can withhold money if you're not making progress. What we can do, though, is terminate the grant. And so our goal is not to terminate any of these grants because we're assuming that all of these schools will go into this in good faith, really truly wanting to make these changes and moving their students ahead. And so we will, if a district or if a school chooses to build that into their model that they've chosen, they certainly can do so. There are specific requirements with each of the four models, and you can go beyond what's in the model. You just can't take away from what's in the model. So rewards are one.
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Has there been any thought to what the role of technology will be with regard to these turnaround schools? I know I have been very impressed with those schools that have invested in the technology tools in the classroom, how they have a very high engagement with those students. Are we working on that? Have you been? You're nodding, so it looks like there is a role for technology. Would you share that?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, actually one of the other grants that our division oversees is the EdTech, our Education Technology Grants. And so we received some funding for that under the stimulus program. And with that, one of the requirements was to develop online professional development for your district and then be able to share that statewide. And so we're looking at some of the best practices that are starting to come out of that and the staff that are working with that program to ensure that we have a technology-based school for each of these 34 schools, because 21st century skills require that you have technology embedded into the classroom on a regular basis. And so we are very excited about the opportunity to embed technology into this program.
Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair and Director King, so for example, how about interactive whiteboards? How about those handheld pieces where the teacher can actually have the students do a problem and they see in real time how many students got it right, you know, what their intervention is to whether or not they got it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, with this particular program, what we're looking at is if this is what schools feel that they need to do to move forward, we will support this. What we want to ensure that is that schools just aren't purchasing whiteboards to put on the wall. We want the professional development that goes with that whiteboard so that all of those teachers in that school truly understand how to use those whiteboards or any other kind of technology equipment. So the key is all about creating capacity.
One more follow-up, Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, it seems to me that going back to the Race to the Top application where they ask us to identify how we're going to use our so-called super teachers as mentors for the rest of the state, it seems to me that districts that have been highlighted for their successful use of those applications would be the perfect teachers to be on a SWAT team going into those underperforming schools and doing that kind of professional development.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, that's a very good example of how we would perceive these schools becoming new schools almost in Minnesota, a different way of thinking about things and how professional development and the sharing between from teacher to teacher and professional to professional should be happening in the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay, I will, Mr. Chair, I will quickly finish up the rest of this PowerPoint. It's a lot of, as you can see, a lot of assurances. I think the key in these assurances, I think one of the only other one that I want to point out here is this process has to be extremely transparent. And so all of the work that is done with these schools will be posted to our department website. For example, each of the approved applications for these schools, the schools that intend apply and receive funding, their applications will be posted on the website, on our department website. We're required to do that. Our application in Minnesota, I'm very proud to say that we were the second state in the union to be approved for our school improvement grant. And this, I can't even imagine what other states are doing right now, knowing that all of this has to happen by the first day of the start of the school year. So we're very pleased that we made it this far this fast, and we feel like we're still not going fast enough. Because as I said earlier, our goal is not to stand in the way of these schools and allow them sufficient time. So now I would like to just move on. The next document, I'm not going to go through this one in its entirety, but I think what I would like to just talk about the school improvement grant implementation plan for Minnesota. The key with this document is this is the document that was shared with every school district in the state that we met with. And so I wanted to share it with you here today, and I also want to talk about just a couple of key things and then allow the rest of the time if you'd like to ask some questions about the models. What we first of all, the very first section is just talking about where we're at. The identification, which we've already talked about, is the phase one document. On page two, looking at the establishment of a turnaround office, that is under construction, I guess would be a good way to put it. Our goal right now is to get information out, work with schools, the Office of Turnaround Schools. We can put that together, but I think we need to focus on being here for the schools right now and getting the quality school reviews off the ground. Again, phase three, we had our initial meetings with the school districts across the state. I was very personally pleased by the professionalism around the state of the teachers, of the staff, of the administration welcoming us into their districts and having good conversations about where do we go from here. I was very proud of all of those school districts. The next phase four is establishing the process for the identification of this intervention model. Once the quality school reviews are complete, the information will be given back to the schools. The schools will then have an opportunity to look at, actually the district on behalf of a school will have an opportunity to determine which model they will apply for. Capacity factors during the quality school review, some of the things that the quality school review team will be looking at is what are the schools doing really well and what are improvements that need to be made. They will be having different meetings with different staff, with students, visiting classrooms, leadership, community members. Really, it's an open invitation for that particular school to show off what it is they're doing and who they might want to talk to. So it's a very comprehensive review, and I certainly could provide you with more information on that if you would like. On page four, the completing the application for the school.
Excuse me, Ms. King, every potential school or charter is involved.
Every potential, Mr. Chair, you're exactly right. We have received a letter of intent from each of these individual schools, and so each of these schools is receiving a quality school review. So regardless of their decision, that information is then at least available to them should they choose not to apply. Page four, looking at applying for the school improvement grant and implementing the intervention model. Page five is a very quick overview of this compressed timeline that I just spoke to. For implementation again by the first day of the start of school year, and we all know a lot of work has to happen before then. And now I think there are a number of other pieces of information in this document, such as the list of low-performing schools. We could talk about the calculation, the definition. I think that starts on page 12 here. This is actually posted. It's on page the letter of intent is on page 12. The definition of persistently low-achieving schools starts on page 13. Just for your information, you can certainly take a look at that, ask questions if you'd like. The definition of schools, the calculation of schools, is posted to our department website. It's been up since January 19th. But I believe the piece that people probably want to talk a little bit more today about is the information on page 6. Regarding the comparison of the required activities for the various intervention models. As I stated, there are four models: the turnaround model, the transformation model, the restart model, and the school closure model. The school closure model would take effect maybe, and I don't know what circumstances that might happen under. We don't know. But again, it will be the district's responsibility to determine that or the charter school authorizer's responsibility to determine that. But should a school closure model be chosen, it's important to note that the students that are attending those schools, there has to be an opportunity for those students to attend a higher performing school within a geographic region. So it isn't an option just to shut down a school. Rather, there has to be a plan in place for that. The restart model, an opportunity here for an educational management organization, EMO, or a charter management organization, a CMO, to come in and basically it's closed down the school and you start all over again. That is an option that school districts could choose. And then we have a transformation model and the turnaround model. One of the waivers that we were able to get out of the U.S. Department of Education, there are a couple of waivers I think that are very important. One of them is Title I school-wide. In a school-wide Title I model, districts have the opportunity.
Ms. King,
excuse me.
Is any legislation needed for the broad power you would have here?
Mr. Chair, that's a very good question. At the end of the day, I don't believe the department necessarily has the power. It's the district who makes the decision on which of the intervention models they would choose to put in place. And again, it goes back to the district can choose to apply on behalf of their schools or choose not to apply on behalf of their schools.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Sarah Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question about the schools themselves. Ms. King, the 34 schools on the list, any of them surprised to be on the list as they've gone through this process? Were any of them shocked to discover that they were one of the lowest performing schools in the state, or were these things all well known and there had been a process of sort of leading up to this? And so, I mean, can you talk a little bit about that?
Ms. King?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, it's no doubt that it was a surprise for some of the schools on this list, and I think there are a couple of reasons why, but I think the most important reason why is that some of the schools on this list, especially the Tier 2 schools, are schools that were eligible for but not receiving Title I funds, which means that they've not had an AYP or an Adequate Yearly Progress in Need of Improvement designation. And those are the schools that were most surprised by being on this list. In fact, one of the comments I heard was, well, no one ever told us we weren't doing well. And whether or not you have an AYP or in need of improvement designation, it really is the responsibility of the district to watch the progress of the students. And so while it was a surprise to them, because I don't think that they weren't on our radar anyway, and so I don't know about being on their own radar. The schools, just to give you a little context here, this list was determined back in January. We made phone calls to each of these schools back in January prior to the submission of Race to the Top. The information really wasn't out until probably late February. And at that point, it sort of surfaced through the media and different things. And at that point, it became real, I guess, for everyone, for lack of a better way to say it. And I believe that there are still a couple of school districts who really are quite surprised yet and don't feel that they belong on this list.
Sarah Hand, followed by
yes,
Senator
Mr. Chairman, and thank you, and Ms. King. For some of those schools that follow that category you just described that were surprised to find themselves on the list, are there waiver opportunities or if they say, well, look, we're not prepared to do any of these four things, but we realize we need to do something, but we don't, is there a process where they say, well, we want to do something and we want to take some money to do it, but not one of these four things. Is that a possibility or not?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, not under the school improvement grant model. That grant is very specific as to what you need to do to participate. As Director King said, they have Title I monies that they can repurpose. They have their ARRA monies that they can repurpose if they want to do some. But you know, we have encouraged them to use this as an opportunity. Remember, all of our schools, whether we had Title I schools or not, we all had report cards, and we all knew whether subgroups of our students were achieving or not achieving, but we weren't under any consequences. We weren't under anything except to say, well, we have subgroups of kids that are not achieving, but we're not Title I, so it doesn't mean anything except that it's out there in the public for us to be made uncomfortable about. But we really don't have to do anything if we don't want to. Now, I don't think that that's what happened in many of our schools. I think that they did roll up their sleeves and they did try to help address the needs of kids that were in areas. But what we discovered, as we looked at the formula, that there were some high schools, particularly, that were really struggling, and that they really could benefit from some additional help. Again, as I said, some of these schools had been starting to implement some things, but for the lack of resources, were scaling up some things but didn't have the complete opportunity to do so. So what we're hoping and trying to encourage is that no one looks at this as a negative, but that as there's an opportunity that there are some children that are struggling, that want to learn, that teachers are there to want to educate and help these students, and we can come alongside as partners and see if we can't make a difference. And with $1 million or so of monies on top of the resources that you have already, you surely should be able to do some restructuring and planning and make some progress that is significant over this next 3 years. That's what we want to do. That's our hope. That's our dream. That's what President Obama's hope and dream is. And I think that we need to take advantage of it instead of, maybe possibly being in some denial.
We'll go to Senator Bonoff and then Senator Dahl and Senator Torres-Ray. What I'd like to do at maybe 10:20 to 10:30 is to also invite some members of the audience that would like to share any observations. Potentially some of the schools that are on the list that we're talking about are represented here, and I think that would help in our conversation as well. So, Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm confused, Dr. King. How could a district not have ever triggered an AYP label and still be one of our lowest performing schools? Is this rubric not focused on those subpopulations that No Child Left Behind was, those subgroups, or is this more of a progress-oriented benchmark approach? Could you share what might be a situation where we wouldn't have had some level of broad exposure to these schools?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, under the umbrella of AYP or Adequate Yearly Progress, only those schools that receive Title I funding receive a consequence if they don't make adequate yearly progress.
Mr. Chair, but we still know that they're not making adequate yearly progress, so I'm not talking about the consequence.
Right. Mr. Chair.
Commissioner.
Senator Dubanoff, as I just said, we have report cards, and we have report cards for the elementary, the middle school, and the high schools. And it's clear, and it articulates how many students have met proficiency in your math and your reading. So that is out there, and people do know that, and they do know that by disaggregated scores. There's the awareness. I think because there were no consequences, there was not probably the drive, I guess, to make some changes, except, to know that they had subgroups of kids that were struggling and wanted to try to make some progress, but there was not that kind of hammer, I think, to make them maybe drive harder. But it's not to say that they weren't trying to help their students, but there was no consequence. But, yes, it is out there. It was transparent. So that's a question maybe you should ask them.
But, Mr. Chair, and so, Commissioner, really all the schools in that lower quadrant didn't make AYP, and that would be noted. There couldn't have been a case where a school was making AYP and now found themselves in that group. That's number one. And then the second thing is, with regard to the Title I funds, do we have a situation where we have a school that's in that list and they don't have a concentration of poverty such that they would be getting Title I? Are those examples in our state?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, the Title I formula is very interesting sometimes, and I think with the Tier 2 schools, specifically that group, I think that's sort of what we're talking about right now, which is that group that's eligible for but not receiving. Under the Title I legislation, most of those school districts, if you look at their numbers, they're probably under 1,000 students. And so under Title I formula, they call that target as a whole. So the district can obviously put the funding where they choose to fit. There's a lot of latitude for districts to be able to determine how they might want to put that funding in there. What we've seen, and as I said earlier, I work with the complete statewide system of support for the school improvement or for for schools not making adequate yearly progress. So I've seen this play out in a number of ways across the state. For the most part, most of those schools that are on that Tier 2 list, not all of them, but most of them, their district has been identified as corrective action under AYP, or adequate yearly progress. In many cases, the elementary schools are showing up on the Tier 3 list. So it was only a matter of time in some cases for that secondary school to start showing up. The other issue that we've been diagnosing this a little bit, there's a couple of things to keep in mind. This calculation is very, very different than the AYP calculation. This calculation required that you look at math and reading of tested grades, no subgroups, math and reading of tested grades and proficiency over 3 years, where over here you have AYP and you're looking at subgroups and different things. And so over in the case of many of these secondary schools that are eligible for but not receiving Title I funds, they hadn't been on that radar, that specific school. The district was, the elementary school was, but the secondary school wasn't necessarily on. And I think what heightens the level of awareness in Minnesota for some of these schools is, number one, they have the consequences, but number two, they also have to develop a school improvement plan. So these schools have not had to ever develop a school improvement plan, at least for our purposes under Title I, and they have not ever had to face any of the consequences such as school choice or supplemental education services. So in a district where you have a very small group, a number of students, and you have an elementary that is facing these consequences and having to write a plan, and the district has to write a plan, and you have people who are stretched in their jobs, not having to write another plan for that particular school. It's not an excuse, but it's just sort of what happens.
Got it.
But it doesn't excuse us from not looking at the data.
Thank you.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director King or Commissioner Segrin, as I look at the models and the interventions that are listed in the models, I assume this all was developed by the U.S. Department of Education. Is there anything on the list that you don't completely buy into as terms of an effective intervention? I mean, this federal government gives you a list, but as Minnesota has pretty high-quality education system. Is there anything on that list that you might have concerns about as an actual implement intervention model?
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Segrin, you're...
I'm on the hot seat.
Yes. Okay.
Got to be careful here. We got to go for a new application, second application for race to that. No, seriously, I think that some of the current concerns that I had were, just the hard and fast rule that a principal would be removed without, first of all, some evaluation of that principal's success. I think that there is some wiggle room in the application or in the grant process where they do look, I think, at a two-year, if a principal has been in their position 2 years or less, I think they are exempt from removal. But if you have a principal that maybe has been in their position for a number of years, there really isn't any choice. But there was no ability to analyze and say, whether there was some criteria or evaluation mechanism. Also, many times the principal does not have the flexibility to build the staff that they need to build or hire the staff that they need to meet the needs of their children because of contractual requirements with the teachers' union. So sometimes you have to work around that, or districts have worked through those kinds of situations. So sometimes while the principal is charged with all of this responsibility to build a team and to make it successful, they don't necessarily have the ability to build the staff and team that they need. So that is a concern. There is also the concern of just under the turnaround model of removing half of the teaching staff again. But on the other hand, this is something that can be worked through and negotiated if that's a choice for the school district or the charter who is identified. They may choose the transformation model, and there may be, as Director King said, an opportunity for a principal to take a different role as a manager and come alongside another team member to do some instructional work. So I think that's probably the areas where, without having an evaluation mechanism and a screen to have sort of these blunt methods is concerning. However, we have, I was with Secretary Duncan about 3 weeks ago. I was in a room of a number of chiefs, and many of us brought up some of the issues around that. We felt that a lot of times this was an urban strategy that didn't necessarily fit some of our rural areas. And I can tell you the numbers of states who really asked for some flexibility along the lines that I'm describing. And Secretary Duncan was very adamant that this was going to be the strategy that was used. And he was unmoved in his position. And I can tell you there were probably at least 10 to 15 states, Minnesota among them, whose chiefs expressed concern about is particularly the rural issue and that there needed to be some flexibility. I think that they've given us a little, you know, room to maneuver and address that. But his, frankly, his comment was, if someone has been in a job for, you know, more than 2 or 3 years and has not been able to accomplish what they need to accomplish, then there needs to be some different strategies. And that seems pretty tough, but I think it again expresses what the president and he has been saying is that we no longer can wait and that our children are moving through in these 3 years' time. And if we're not getting them to an achievement level, then we need to do something dramatic. And I think that's what they are looking at, dramatic strategies to change us. Having said that, we will work within our parameters to do it thoughtfully and do everything we can to help support these 34 schools to become lighthouse schools for our nation. I hope that this will be an opportunity, and I hope that all of us, if we have a school within our that we represent as legislators, that you all do, that you will come alongside them personally, publicly, to help support them as they move through this so that the community also understands that this is a positive and not a negative. And I think the way that we approach that is very, very important.
Senator Saltzman, I believe you had a follow-up on one of those points?
Yes, I do.
Okay, just and then quick, we'll go to Senator Torres Ray.
I think is that, and if you've touched on this, I apologize, but what is the role of charter school sponsors or authorizers in all that? I mean, we've talked about the LEAs, but just to go back, because I know there's a number of charter schools that are on the list, and at the same time, becoming a charter is an option. Mm-hmm. So in a charter school that is being on this list, because we're you know discussing a change in leadership in terms of the principal, what about the sponsor authorizer? Because I think that's where we've had some discussions within our authorizer sponsors doing their job, because we're counting on them, and some of them have not been doing their job.
And Ms. King, I believe you did say earlier that in the agreement you're not precluded by any number of options, but go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senator Saltzman, the role of the authorizer is almost identical to that of the role of the superintendent or the district. And so we're looking at that as the level of oversight for these charter schools.
Okay. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Bonoff, I think, asked some very important questions with respect to how we measure and the connection with AYP and the calculation you said is different. I have a related question with respect to how we use the diagnostic that Cambridge is going to be hired or has been hired to do, and how the department actually intends to use that information to measure and create some consistency, because part of what I hear you say is that you're not going to intervene because this really is the responsibility of the district and the school. On the other hand, we have, if we say, well, 34 schools are going to do their own thing, and everyone is going to go in their own direction, and then what do we learn out of it? I mean, there is some balance, I think, in that, in trying to say that there has to be some guidance, there has to be, you know, kind of some research-based strategies, not everybody going on their own, and if they fail, well, you know, it was their thing. The department didn't have any responsibility over that. Because you are doing a diagnosis, and I think a diagnosis is a very important tool. It's a point of departure. Then you know what you have. You know your foundation, your base. So could you talk about kind of that balance on how do you use this? You're hiring the consultant to establish the foundation. On the other hand, you're giving kind of that responsibility to the individual district and school. Could you talk a little bit about what is your plan to balance that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Senator Torres-Ray, what we're looking at, the way that this is unfolding, and these are very good questions, what we're looking at, first of all, is having the diagnostic done with the school to help determine the intervention model. That's step number one. Once the intervention, and the intervention model, again, will not be chosen by the diagnostic team and will not be chosen by the department. Rather, it will be chosen then by the district or the charter school authorizer to determine which makes the most sense. Once that has been chosen, then it's the responsibility to write the application, submit the application. It's the department's responsibility to review that application to ensure that they have the capacity to implement that particular model. And that will come from we have a rubric in our application, actually, that with very specific things that we have to look for. And so we'll be looking at the connection between what came out of the diagnostic review and how was the decision to implement this particular model determined, and then what kind of support will this school need in order to ensure that this is even doable within the school. And so some of those pieces are going to be the responsibility of the Office of Turnaround Schools to develop that oversight. We're also looking at, to ensure that this happens with credibility and fidelity, that we're looking at each of these schools hiring or making sure they have on staff someone who reports to, whether full-time or part-time, to the Office of Turnaround Schools. So we can't lose sight and just let these 34 schools go forth and say, do well, good luck, you know, we wish you all the best. We're not willing to do that. We will do whatever we can to partner with these schools and provide the right direction, because I know that in the past we've not been able to do that, and this is an opportunity for us to take our lessons learned and figure out how we can do this right and make sure that these schools have what they need to turn themselves around.
Thank you. And Commissioner and Ms. King, if you'd like to wrap up on the formal part of your presentation, then we'll see if there's any additional committee questions, and then I'd like to open it up to the audience for some feedback. And I'll ask first from the audience, when we're at this point, to hear from schools that are amongst the 34, if you're represented, or if you would like to voluntarily share any concerns, because I do know you're here and I appreciate your attention this morning.
Mr. Chair, just to wrap it up a little bit, I think I've talked a lot about the condensed timeline that we're under. It's our commitment to work with these schools. We also know that the Office of Turnaround Schools can't be the end-all, and we also know that the department can't be the end-all. Therefore, we're looking at developing some criteria for a list of vendors that schools can pick from to provide assistance in the implementation of the particular model that they choose. We also want to be very careful about ensuring that however it is that we go about this process, it's very credible. And not, we want to make sure that schools have what they need, not just purchasing another next best thing, thinking that that's going to be what's going to take care of it. So that part will be unfolding. It's in our application. We'll be developing that. Our goal right now is to really get these quality school reviews underway and work with these schools and provide any kind of technical assistance that we can to them. The models, intervention models, are listed on page 6. Page 7 goes and so on goes through in more specific detail. We do have information on our department website. The department, U.S. Department of Education, has created a frequently asked questions document, which now they've amended and added more questions 4 times with 4 different components. And the reason for that is because with any time you have prescriptiveness, there's also more ambiguity because you're always trying to figure out exactly what is meant. So we're constantly learning more and more about this program. And so, it's our intent as I wrap up to really work with these schools who are committed to applying for this grant and doing whatever we can as a department to increase student achievement in the state of Minnesota.
Could we also get some information about what waivers you may have applied for that you did not get, or just a snapshot overall on it?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I can speak to a couple of those right off the top of my head, but then I can send you a couple of other, just to make sure that I've covered all three of them. The first waiver that we applied for was for any of these schools who happen to be, it's for a Title I school-wide program. And for schools that are less than 40%, you have to do what's called a targeted assistance program, meaning that you can only select and serve specific kids. What we would hope for in these particular schools is that there's a lot more flexibility and every student can be served under Title I. So we've applied for and received that waiver. The second waiver that we applied for and received was the extension of a timeline for the use of the funding. Typically, it's 27 months. We were able to extend it for an additional year, so the funding runs out on September 30th of 2013. So that one we were successful in. And the other waiver was, it's an important waiver that we've actually been able to offer to our schools. And this is a waiver to sort of restart the clock with your AYP or your in need of improvement status. And so for some schools that are on our list, they're in the pre-restructuring phase or they're in the restructuring phase or the corrective action phase, we will be able to allow that school to actually truly start over as a brand new school under AYP. And so they can go back to, I don't know if you think about it as stage zero or whatever, but they won't have to comply with all of this other requirement of setting aside all of these fundings, resources. We need to make sure that's freed up so these schools can truly start over again on a clean slate. So those are the three that we applied for and we received.
Thank you. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we let you go, I just want to thank you. And Commissioner, I thank you for your leadership, for you to be open to what this opportunity is, and then to direct your staff to become students of this is not easy, and it's complicated, and it's intimidating, and I can see how many states may have at first glance said, no, thank you, we aren't interested in having this be part of what we're looking at, and you didn't do that. You embraced it, and you applied for it, and you got it, and so I very much appreciate you, your leadership in taking this on.
And that's on behalf of our committee as well. And thank you, Senator Bonner, for sharing that. We will ask potentially Ms. King or Commissioner to readdress us. In fact, you're welcome to stay at the table. But I'd like now to ask anyone that represents a school among the 34, and if you would like to come to the table, I see two hands. If there's three, please join us. Four. I think there's room for four. And I'll ask you to go in whichever order you'd like and to state your name for the record, the school. And if you could limit your comments at this point to no more than 4 to 5 minutes in respect to the hour. Welcome.
Welcome. How do you do? My name is David Ellis, and I'm the founder of High School for Recording Arts.
My name is Tony Simmons. I'm Director of Development at High School for Recording Arts.
I'm Kevin Byrne, the Executive Director of Minnesota Internship Center Charter High Schools.
Brian Bass, Principal, Brooklyn Center High School.
Okay. I'd like to start.
Sure. I'll start first.
And for our record, you may have to just restate your name, too, in case they don't pick that up.
My name is Tony Simmons, and again, I'm Director of Development at High School for Recording Arts. I'd like to thank the chair and this committee first for allowing us the opportunity to speak. And I would like to begin first by saying that to the left of me is David Ellis, the founder of High School for Recording Arts, and we helped develop the school, but right at this time, our program director, our staff, is currently at the school working with young people, and we're here on their behalf as developers of the school. We would also like to begin by saying that we truly commend the department in coming forward today and explaining this process. We know that it's a very tough situation with respect to identifying schools as persistently low as achieving, especially when I know the department recognized that people are working really hard. This is an opportunity for the state to get much-needed resources, and we support that. We support ongoing, continuous school improvement, accountability. But with respect to our particular situation, the High School for Recording Arts, 12 years ago when we applied for a charter, we stated explicitly in that charter that we wanted to serve young people who had either dropped out or been kicked out of high school, those overage, undercredited young people. And that was the proposal that was approved for our charter. And 12 years later, that is still the population that we serve. We're on the persistently lowest achieving school list only for the fact that we were not able to achieve a 60% four-year on-time graduation rate. Yet, to be able to serve that population that we currently serve and have served for 12 years, it would have been impossible for us to achieve a 60% four-year on-time graduation. Over half of our graduates are over the age of 18, and they literally do not count in that calculation. We are not on the lowest achieving list for being on the 5%, bottom 5% of proficiency. In fact, when you look at the list of the 34 schools, how the department tracks student growth, we're at over 54% student growth and proficiency with respect to matters around test scores and showing growth in that pattern. So for us to be on this list really is a misidentification of our purpose that the state has approved. And we're concerned that there is guidelines from the federal department that specifically accounts for schools that are in our situation for them to make exceptions for to not being on the list. Now, one might say, well, wouldn't you just want all of that money? And of course, we want as much money as we could possibly get to support our practice. But in this case, in terms of the whole strategy around improving a situation that brought you on the list in the first place, that is not going to be a what we believe a prudent allocation of resources, because the very nature of the population we serve, we're not going to get to a 60% four-year on-time graduation rate. And we know that there are other ways that we can continue to work with the department, and we're open to doing that outside of this particular process. And there's other places that resources could probably go to, because we're part of the community too. And we know that there are some dropout factories, and we know that those resources could be used to help save the young people that we strive every day to work with and to save. But we just we believe that in this particular case, we have misidentified being part of the list. We believe the department has the discretion to correct that situation. We look forward to working with the department. We've had communications with them. We've had dialogue. It's ongoing, and we hope that we could reach a resolution with respect to that particular case. And we know there are other schools in that category as well. And, you know, we support their efforts in the same vein.
I would just like to...
And if you restate your name for the tape.
Yes. My name is David Ellis, and I'm the founder of High School for Recording Arts. And I just wanted to state that the intention and the design of High School for Recording Arts was to be the solution to the problem of dropouts. And we've been very successful with attracting and re-engaging students who had dropped out of school and are now back in our program and are doing very, very well. We've been very successful. And I know we've been searching and trying to solve this problem. We couldn't understand, you know, why we would be on this list. Again, I was thinking it wouldn't seem right to spend money on something that couldn't be corrected just by the very nature of the population, the demographic of the students we serve, because the majority of them are overage and undercredited. They come to us 17 and a half years old, and they're 2 or 3 years behind in credit. They haven't been served at the previous schools they've been to. And then they come to us, and so now we're getting identified as a persistently low achieving school, which is incorrect. So we've been researching and we found some clarification in the federal regulation with regards to a school like ours. And it's very specific, and we fit exactly into that category, and it states one narrow exception to the general rule above may be a category constituting a school's specifically designed for, excuse me. Can you see that, Tony? I lost my glasses.
I have mine. One narrow exception to the general rule above may be a category consisting of schools specifically designed to serve overage unaccredited students, i.e., schools designed to reengage students who have dropped out of high school and who, by definition, cannot graduate within the standard number of years. Such a category would include schools that might automatically be identified as among the persistently lowest achieving schools by virtue of the 60% graduation rate prong of the definition. Within this category, an SEA may decide on a case-by-case basis, giving careful consideration to the mission of a particular school, student performance, and the intent of SIG final requirements, to exclude such a school from its list of persistently lowest achieving schools.
So with that being said, again, I just, you know, I reach out, I mean, to the State Department of Education to be an advocate for our school and to understand our population and the demographics of the young people that we're working with, because what we're doing is very effective and we're having a tremendous impact on educating and giving these kids, who a lot of them have not had a good experience in the traditional public school, we're giving them an opportunity to reach their heights of their capability and potential. And I know this for a fact because I am a product of a school like that. I graduated from the St. Paul Open School, which, after being kicked out of numerous schools in the community, I ended up at Open School, and they took a different approach, and they understood, and they worked with me, and they were able to guide me into understanding what education was and how it could affect me and help me be a productive lifelong learner. And that is the very reason why I founded this school. I was a recording artist with Prince, and when he changed his name to The Symbol and he wanted to get away from his contract with Warner Brothers, I was signed to his label. I opened a recording studio, and it was based in the Skywalk level downtown in St. Paul. Well, all the kids that were ditching school, who were hanging out, you know, surrounding me and asking me, hey, let me get in the studio. I can do this. I'm a great rapper. Let me show you what I got. And I was basically blowing them off because I had clients. I was like, no, I got somebody coming. I don't have time. You know, and so they were consistently harassing me. So one day they called me. They said, you said you had an appointment at 2. It's 2:30. Nobody's here. I could have already, you know. So I let them in the studio, and they blew me away with what they were capable of doing. I was like, then they wanted to know, how do you publish? How do you copyright? They wanted to know everything I knew about the music industry immediately. So then I saw a need in the community that I was in. All these kids disengaged, not in school. And so that was the creation of High School for Recording Arts. And that's why I'm here to testify, to let you know that this needs to be corrected, because there's an illogical process that's going on with regards to us being identified. And I liken it sometimes to what happened in the financial district, where they create these exotic formulas and derivatives, and they have these calculations, and they say this $12 is worth $12,000, and then when it really hits the road out on the street, it doesn't match. And that's what I like in this process to happen, is that they're not really looking at our school for what it really does. We're not a persistently low-achieving school. We're not a dropout factory. And I know that Obama administration and Arne Duncan have made it clear that that is not the schools like ours doing what we're doing are not what they're looking to try and close or turn around, because if we turned around what we were doing, it would be a negative impact. So
thank you. And Mr. Ellis, I had a question. Has the High School for Recording Arts submitted a letter of intent for the, or your authorizer for
no,
this program?
No, not at this time.
Not at this time.
Are you willing to indicate, based on the positive discussions you've had thus far, whether that's likely or not prepared to comment?
Well, we asked the department for an extension so that our board could take up this matter, and when the department visited our school about this process, they offered to attend that board meeting, and that's going to take place next week. We were very grateful that the department gave us an extension, and that matter is going to be taken up before our board next week.
Thank you. Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. Mr. Harris, when you pulled out your iPhone, I thought you were going to play me a tune from one of your students. But I just want to thank you for your testimony, both of you, and I gained some valuable insight on at least one of the schools on the list. Thank you.
Thank you.
I represent, I'm sorry.
Yes, go ahead.
Kevin Byrne, I represent, founded and I'm the executive director of Minnesota Internship Center Charter School. We have four sites in Minneapolis. They're relatively small as sites to keep the friction down and the community ownership open. But like HSRA, our charter was specifically to reach out to kids who have no other options, who have been out of school. We never have transfers from other schools. We recruit them out of the basements, out of correctional institutions. That's who we go for. That's all we go for. So the average age is 17 and a half when they come to us. The reading level is fourth grade, but the math is worse. So for them to reach the a graduation at 18, which the legislation calls for, is just a fantasy. There is no intervention model that could do that that we know of. When we talked, we were treated very respectfully by the department when they came out. We said, we'd like to have the money because we're losing out of this. We're losing two school improvement grants. You know, that money is going to. So we'd like to continue the hard work we're doing. But if we were able to get students who had 3 years of high school to complete or even more in 6 months, we'd be on the cover of Time magazine. And I said, but I want to be on the cover of Time magazine, so we'd like the money. We'd like to continue to do the work we're doing and get the help we're doing. We have a, I don't know if it's appropriate to pass this out, because we cited the the other folks were talking about, the area in the federal guidance that allows the a change to what they call an extended year adjusted cohort graduation rate. So we can still do this if we can not finish up at 18, because it just eventually it will close our schools, and the effect of that will be 2,000 of the lowest income kids in Minnesota without an education. A third of our students are homeless. A third are parents. A lot of them are both. Some of our students have no credits. Some of them were slaves in their own countries, or prostitute slaves in this country. So for them to, the idea that you know, 6 months that they can reach that level ain't going to happen. But given more time, and we have an example chosen from the federal language of a 6 year extended cohort rate, I think we can do this, because we know this. We can, if we can get a kid into a job or an internship, that kid's going to graduate.
Yes.
It takes a long time to get there, though. But if we can get them there, if we can get them, I'm sure HSRA, we have one of my staff persons has a son there. If we can get them there, get them working in the programs like HSRA are making, they're going to graduate. But we can't do it in the limited amount of time. Our school is also the only charter school in Minnesota that is an authorized provider of adult basic education, so that we can extend that time. If a student turns 21, we keep them. We'll finish them up. And given just that, what we'd ask for is if we can have that that change, because we did send in a letter of intent. We would like that change. Use the federally designated I believe the commissioner would have to apply for this. Allow that to be extended into approved adult basic education programs who are also allowed to provide diplomas. To eliminate the removal of the principal clause, removing our principal from a school like ours is not going to do anything. We could remove him time after time. What I would do is the only way to reach this 18 thing would be to recruit students who are already in school, Minneapolis schools or other schools, who are much more successful already. And if I found that to be happening, if I found our rate was growing like that, I would fire that principal because they're off of the mission. Our mission is right in here, and it's strictly to reach for the kids, the young adults who are at the lowest levels. So thank you for the opportunity to talk, and I appreciate it.
And as well, we want to thank you for your mission and helping these students survive. And we do have your handout, and we're pleased, reassured there's ongoing dialogue with the department and hopefully a recognition for common sense in the application of this from the federal government down to address the goal everyone shares to increase student achievement and graduation rate. So. Yes.
Mr. Chair, Senators Brian Bass, Principal of Brooklyn Center, Brooklyn Center High School. Intrinsically motivated turnaround agent as well. I want to thank Commissioner Segrin and Director King. They have been extremely supportive of Brooklyn Center Schools over the time of my tenure, which began 4 years ago. 4 years ago, I was offered the opportunity to take the helm at Brooklyn Center High School, a school that was in need of change and turnaround like no kidding. And during this time, we have taken a graduation rate of students who are graduating and reporting going off to college at 38% to now over 78% of our seniors who are graduating are reporting going off to post-secondary education. In addition, we have earned two National Magnet Schools of Excellence Awards. We were just recently authorized as an International Baccalaureate World School this past March. And so we have absolutely rolled up our sleeves, are intolerant of an achievement gap, and have created professional learning communities for our teachers to organize themselves to really get curious in looking at the achievement gap and the persistently low performance of our students, specifically as it relates to literacy and math. We have adopted the state's recommendation for merit-based pay with a QCOMP model with our teachers. We do have teachers, 100% of them, participating in a PLC each week that looks at content literacy and literacy strategies and best practices for their areas. And do believe that we, based on our internal assessments, our internal diagnostics, will show substantial growth in our scores coming up starting next week in the testing that takes place. The concern we have with the four models is that they are prescriptive and one size does not fit all. They're narrow, and the components of the transformational plan, there are some elements there that would support intensifying the efforts that we are making with respect to literacy and math, and would absolutely be interested in that support and the funding that would accompany that. Obviously, when I say intrinsically motivated, I chose to come to a school and chose to work in a community that absolutely wanted to do something about the low performance of students, particularly students of color. And during this time, our poverty has increased to 75.7% from 67%. Our ELL population has increased to 30%. And our special ed population has increased to 11% during my tenure at the school. And so I present to you today that we are very concerned about a one-size-fits-all, very concerned about disrupting the leadership and the flow of our site, and absolutely would like special consideration given for, in the transformation model, the removal of the principal. So this is my fourth year, so I don't fit the 2 years or less clause.
Thank you, Mr. Bass. We have questions from Senator Bonhoff and Senator Saltzman, and I'd also like to include for testimony before we end Mr. Piccolo, who had asked earlier, and Ms. Allswager. If there's anyone else, please let us know so we can hopefully accommodate you. Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bass, I've been out to your school. I've toured it. I've seen what you've done with kids, and it is remarkable. So I can understand how your first reaction might be, you know, you don't want to lose your job. You're doing an outstanding job. But if, you know, maybe perhaps they'll get a waiver. But let's say that doesn't happen. Could you see a scenario where for a short period of time a business person gets put in your office like has been put as one of the options, and you get to actually spend all of your time engaging with teachers, much more in the classroom activity? It looked to me, as I looked at those turnaround options, one of the options was for the principal, who's an outstanding principal, to take a different role within the school and put a business person in that office and let them do some of that, but in fact not to take away your leadership capabilities and your extraordinary talent, which I think we would all agree that you have, but put it to better use where it's closer to the front lines until you have the type of ongoing stability that you're looking for.
Mr. Bass. Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoff, I would defer to the commissioner and the director, Commissioner Segrin and Director King, in terms of the interpretation of that language. That isn't the interpretation that I read from it. So if that is, in fact, an option, I would wholeheartedly embrace the idea of continuing as an instructional leader, as I am extremely passionate about that role.
Mr. Chair, would you like that question to be answered at this time, or would you like that to be given to us in follow-up?
Follow-up.
Okay.
Senator Saltzman.
There, on the same point, Mr. Chair and Mr. Bask, I want to thank you for coming today, because I look at the four people at the table and I see that you are the one who is sitting here, that we're sort of saying, you know, you are targeted as a principal in this process. And yes, I see three other people sitting here who have been involved with their schools for a number of years, and if they're not performing the way we think we should, they're safe, and yet they provide leadership. So I think there is something. I mean, I look at this, and this is where I go back to the authorizer and the fact that, you know, charter schools are sometimes set up a little differently than our school districts, that if a school district isn't performing over time, a school board has the authority to change a superintendent, or the public has the ability to change the school board. But within a charter school, the parents of that school and the staff are the ones who are the change agents. And so I just raise that as a point, that I think it's unfortunate that you are the only one, I feel like, targeted in this process, that we should be looking at leadership in a broader sense, especially when we have smaller, because charter schools typically are smaller than school districts. But I think that's unfortunate. So I do want to just put a note in that I think that you raise a lot of very important points, that somehow if we can consider those, that's very important, because I think we need changing agents like you who are fairly new to the process and are doing really remarkable things in a very difficult school district.
Yeah. Well, response, Mr. Bass?
Mr. Chair, Senator Saltzman? I was told by a very respected elder in the Minneapolis school system that you know, you hotshot young principals, you're prima donnas. You want to come in for 2 to 3 years. You want to go to the central office. You want to rise to fame, and you don't stay. And you don't stay and really impact a community. And that was a decision I made at Brooklyn Center, was to stay and commit, because I had numerous offers, not even at the end of my first year, to leave, and I chose to stay. And I feel like it's a little insulting based on those options, and I do feel targeted. So thank you.
Okay. We want to thank each of the testifiers and continue the dialogue with the department, and we'll stay tuned on the progress. I'd like to invite four additional testifiers, and we'll go in this order, but if each of you could now come to the table. Gene Piccolo, Jan Allswager, Christina Clark, and Jim Bartholomew. We'll go in that order, and if I could ask you to each limit your comments to 2 minutes. Welcome, and Mr. Piccolo.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Just want to reiterate a couple points of our concerns. My name is Eugene Piccolo. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. One is the whole model of these turnarounds is really designed for an urban area, and we have a number of schools that are, as was pointed out, charter schools are traditionally very small schools. The average charter school in the state of Minnesota is just over 200 students. So these models are really geared for, you know, much larger systems than charter schools. And so our concern is about the one-size-fits-all aspect of it. And with regard to the role of principal and school director, one of the things, you had two charter schools here, which are unusual in the sense that they have multiple administrators. But most of our schools, there's one person who is the school director, the principal, the transportation director, the business manager, much like a rural district superintendent. And so they have a multiple role. So in a way, what's going to be happening is they're going to come up with a plan to fire themselves. They've created a plan to improve the school and then have to fire themselves to implement the plan. So we have that concern. And finally, I think one of the concerns is that charter schools do have a particular mission, and was spoken about, as you saw, two examples where their mission was not to be a traditional academic program, to serve specific populations, and that there is that exemption that is possible, and we really encourage the department to look at that option. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Piccolo. Ms. Allswager.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allswager, Education Minnesota, and I have a map that Mr. Nauman is going to hand out to all of you, and I would just like you to think about this in maybe a little more depth, in that in the solutions that we have been offered seem to oversimplify the situation. The map that you are receiving is a map that Education Minnesota produced based on the list of persistently low-achieving schools overlaid on a map produced by Minnesota Kids Count. And it's a percentage of children in poverty. And you will notice that every one of these regular public school districts, we did not include the charter schools, is in a high poverty area, one of the two highest poverty categories. And this just illustrates the fact that schools deal with a number of factors for their kids. And we should look at it in a very broad manner to make sure that we're meeting the needs of the kids, not just in the school setting, but there are other factors as well. Poverty is one, access to health care, the family situation, chemical health issues, mental health issues. Do they have access to housing, to proper nutrition? They all impact the schools. And so I'm not making a statement specifically on the lowest performing schools and the methods, but I am asking everyone to know that teachers, administrators in our schools in Minnesota are doing their very best for kids. But kids come to our schools with a variety of needs, and I think as policymakers it's important for you to consider those in terms of the solutions that we put forward to address the kids' needs.
Thank you. Order-wise, next would be Jim Bartholomew, then Christina Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. And I very much, you've had a fabulous conversation today, and the testifiers you've just heard, great experiences. I just want to emphasize, though, and I think Commissioner Segrin mentioned it, that this program and the identification of these schools has created some discomfort. We've identified them, but we've never before required something to happen as a state policy. And Ms. Allswager is correct. There are a lot of challenges our schools and our teachers face. But I also would encourage us to look at the performance numbers that these schools are generating and many other schools. And then also look at some of the other schools. Because they have low-income students, concentrations, of low-income or non-white students does not predetermine their success levels. There are schools in Minnesota today, public schools, that are doing fabulously well with concentrations of low-income students and concentrations of non-white students. So those factors are not a predeterminant of how well those students can do and succeed. Rather than doing a map and saying, here's some schools that aren't producing and they're in low-income communities, we should be doing a map of schools that are succeeding in low-income communities and ask what they're doing. What can they share with the other schools that are having difficulties? And it's been a fabulous conversation today, a very important one, but I'd also just encourage you to know that income status and ethnic status is not a predeterminant of success, and we should always remember that. Thank you.
Ms. Clark.
Thank you. I'm Christina Clark. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota School Employees Association. We represent school employees who bring your kids to school, feed them, cook for them while they're at school, clean up for them and after them while they're at school, and get them home again. And we also represent employees who support the instructor's work in the classroom and in the special ed setting. We have three schools on the list of 34, we have employees in those schools, and that's Ponima Elementary, Red Lake High School, and Cass Lake High School. These are schools in the, by this point in the hearing, much discussed low poverty areas of our state. And I would like to make a connection between Senator Torres Rey's comment and Senator Dahl's question about the poverty and about the intervention options, which ones maybe aren't so attractive, which ones maybe we should avoid. And I think it also dovetails with some of the testimony earlier that in some of these schools, it does not matter how excellent the teacher, the principal, and the supporting staff are and how hard they work, as long as these kids are not coming ready to learn because of their poverty situation and able to learn and able to stay because of family situation. So I really encourage this committee and the legislature and the department to be looking at that poverty connection. And until we resolve that, we will be unable to address some of the issues that this program requires us to address. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Clark. And because of the lateness of the hour, we won't have time right now for additional questions of the testifiers, but I'm going to ask Commissioner Segrin to rejoin us at the table and just offer a couple observations on what you've heard from the testifiers and next steps. We do have the timetable, letters of intent. This whole thing is in high gear right now, but there's been a plea for some flexibility, and you've said to an extent you've agreed with that, but sum it up for us.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The questions that you have articulated today were really good, and they're the things that we also have talked about internally in the department. To the extent that we can seek any additional waivers, I doubt that we will be able to do that. We have, I think, tried to look at within the application what we could do. We will look at the six-year graduation cohort in relationship to the NGA graduation rate. I am not sure if that is allowed, but we will look at that as a consideration. If it isn't, I would still consider and encourage the charters that have been identified and their mission, that they not give up on going forward with a school improvement grant. We know that a 60% graduation rate may not be realistic for the population that they're dealing with, but if we can set reasonable goals, even internal to those schools, and look at strategies and help and actually allow them to look at even more strategies to help identify the needs of these kids and help them grow even more rapidly, that would be an exciting thing to work on and to help achieve. I do know that there are charter schools around the nation that have these same populations that do have very high graduation rates and are succeeding with students that have been in jail, that have dropped out and are coming back and are doing credit recovery. So there are possibilities, but we will certainly look at whether a six-year cohort graduation rate is possible. I don't know that it will be. one of the things, too, that we need to look at, sometimes you have a good graduation rate, but you have very low proficiency scores in some of these areas, which begs the question is, are we graduating students without really the proficiency that they need? Are we letting them walk across the stage? So we really do have to question, even when we say we've got high graduation rates, what is really going on? We don't want kids graduating without the ability to read and do math. They have to have some basic core academic proficiency. Otherwise, we're lying to them about whether they are able to be a self-sufficient citizen. And I want to just end with this. I shared a little bit about Red Lake and after the school shooting and all of the things that we did to come alongside, and not the department, but many, many people came together as partners. And it was sort of Senator Torres Ray's comment about that we really do need to have lots of resources around these students. And that's what happened at Red Lake. And I want to give you one example. I happen to have a friend who is blessed with a foundation. And she went up to Red Lake and wanted to see if she couldn't help establish a nursery for mothers who became pregnant, who had their babies, and wanted to go back to school at Red Lake. So they built out a facility, some classroom, and turned it into a nursery so that the mothers could come back to school. Last year, the salutatorian, or the valedictorian, I forget which, was one of these teen moms who, because of this additional support, came back to school, continued her education, and graduated. So we can do a lot of things with this school improvement monies. We can build out some of these support services and help these students become successful. We can do the same thing with the High School for Recording Arts, with the other fine programs that are going on. We can look at some strategies. So I would say let's not give up. Let's not say that because of a certain demographic that we just can't do any more. I think we can do more. We can always push ourselves. Let's not let it be a barrier. I am very proud that we do have committed citizens that take some of our hardest to educate children and give them a second chance. And I appreciate and honor that work. We are not trying to tear down that work, neither is the federal government, but we're all trying to come together to try to do the best for kids. Is this a perfect plan? It probably is not as far as the criteria and the way it's going, but let's try to work together to make this work and let Minnesota be a lighthouse.
Thank you very much, Commissioner, and also to Ms. King for your testimony, your efforts, and continue the inclusion of the various people involved, most importantly the parents and students that are ultimately impacted here. And this is a very transparent process. The handouts are on the State Department's web for anyone viewing that wants to see it. This committee will closely monitor the implementation of this, and please keep us posted. We also, for our next meeting, that'll be tomorrow at 8:30, we're going to focus on the charter schools. Senator Saltzman's chaired our special committee on that. And Senator Saltzman, would you like to give us a preview for tomorrow's meeting?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for this little commercial here. I think I afforded to all the members of this committee the delete all amendment. It has gone out to the charter school community. It has gone out to other district school advocates and the different organizations. So I think it has a wide distribution. And we did a delete all amendment because we thought it would be much easier for you to see the entire package. We will note changes that have been made over the past, I think, 6 weeks. We've had extensive discussions with a number of different groups, and so we look forward to really presenting that to you as a new model for financing facilities for our charter schools, and I really appreciate all of the input and work that has been done from a number of people, and I look forward to some spirited discussion tomorrow. So I hope you are able to attend, and it's I think, 31-page bill. I also want to thank our staff, and especially Dr. McQuay for hanging in there. And I don't know if she'll be here tomorrow, but she has certainly done great work, and Mr. Nauman as well, in really putting together what I think is a new model and a new approach. So thank you to everyone who's been involved with the process.
So thank you for your efforts there, and we do hope to see Shelby McQuay tomorrow if she makes it. But for those of you that don't know that are watching, she is very pregnant. And this meeting's adjourned.
Pregnant or not.
Yeah.